Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Before the high-tech gadgets used to track bird migration today, a Louisiana ornithologist studied migration with one simple tool, a telescope aimed at the moon. George Lowry dreamed up moonwatching in the 1940s to prove that birds regularly migrated across the Gulf of Mexico. He knew you could see the silhouettes of migrating birds passing in front of the full moon through a telescope. Working with an astronomer, Lowry turned moonwatching counts into standardized measurements to compare the amount of migration at different places and times. On a ship docked on the coast of Yucatan, Lowry pointed his telescope out over the Gulf. He calculated that 3,700 birds crossed an imaginary one-mile line on the water every hour. Then, in the 1950s, he organized the first continent-wide survey of migration patterns with thousands of volunteers across North America. Moonwatching became obsolete once scientists began using radar to monitor migration. But you can still point a telescope at the moon and see those flickering silhouettes of birds on the move. Learn more about the history of bird migration research in Rebecca Heisman's new book, Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
Chapter 1, The Storyteller.
That's right. Were you an employee or are you now?
A former employee. I was let go on a medical discharge about a week ago. And I've kind of been running across the country. I don't know where to start. They'll triangulate on this position really, really soon.
You can't spend a lot of time on the phone, so give us something quick.
Okay. What we're thinking of as aliens are there. They're extra-dimensional beings that an earlier precursor of the space program made contact with. They are not what they claim to be. They have infiltrated a lot of aspects of the military establishment, particularly the Area 51. The disasters that are coming, the government knows about them, and there's a lot of safe areas in this world that they could begin moving the population to now, Art.
But they're not doing anything.
They are not. They want the major population centers wiped out so that the few that are left will be more easily controllable. I started getting...
I first heard this on a cassette shortly after it aired in 1997. I was 14. And living in my family home in the forests of North Vancouver Island, we were the last driveway at the end of a gravel road. Our house was in the woods among tall Douglas firs, deep salal, and crown land that was occasionally logged. It was the kind of remoteness that made you sit up and take notice if a car randomly drove down the road. My grandparents lived in a house at the back of our 8 acres, and my parents, brothers, and I lived at the front. My brothers and I would go and visit my grandparents all the time, and sometimes my grandma would pop in a cassette for us to listen to. Not music. She listened to Coast AM with Art Bell. It still is a call-in radio show that focuses on the supernatural, but now the host has changed. Back then, it aired at midnight our time, and my grandma would tape episodes that she thought were particularly good for us to listen to when we came over. It's tape like that that made a real impact on me, although The Summer of Freezer Freddy also played its part in my education of extraterrestrials and conspiracy theories that all underpinned why we could never trust the government. One night, a guy called in claiming to be Dr. Jonathan Reed. He said he'd come across a black obelisk in the forest while walking his dog.
All of a sudden, I saw her engaged with what looked to me at the time like a small size dimension figure, very dark, almost black, and it was the size of a child.
He claimed there was an alien there that attacked his dog, so he fought back and whacked it on the head with a branch.
And I wanted to kill it. Mm-hmm. It screamed, I screamed. I think in triumph of trying to stop what I was witnessing, but I almost missed it. I mean, I'm not an athlete. I'm 190 pounds, and but I almost didn't hit it. But as I struck it, head, it started to fall down. The branch had breached its skull. It had broken its skull.
So
it, and
this
it fell
thing
to
was
the ground.
Definitely solid, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he took it home and put it in his freezer, obviously.
I literally just put it, opened the top of the freezer and lowered it down and thought, it's out of sight, out of mind, and now I'm going to go in the house and stand in the shower.
And this was over your meats and frozen.
No, there wasn't much in that freezer. There was a separate rack that I just took out that had some frozen things, you know. And I didn't care. I didn't care. I wanted it out of my sight.
And then some trouble started for him.
After 9 days of having this hell in my house and having my life torn apart, I left the country. I left the United States. I went to Canada because I didn't want my friends, my family, to continue to be harassed. They were burning effigies in their lawns. They were, you know, screaming at them on the phone. There were trucks driving through people's yards. I mean, you name it.
Doctor. All the commotion you just talked about could only come if the news was out, but good.
Well, the news was out enough so that all of my friends were now being threatened.
Okay.
So there was enough people, I call them the dark side, who had basically taken over.
I know the dark
and decided
side.
Yes. To.
Do you hear that? The way Art Bell primes his caller, he teased that story out to a 3-hour show. 3 hours. He was a master of talk radio. He knew what to say to get the best out of his callers. In the case of Freezer Freddy, there's serious doubt on the internet about whether or not Dr. Jonathan Reed is a real person or a man adopting a false identity to make money from speaking fees and book sales. Maybe not all of Art Bell's guests were telling the truth, but many of the fans were in it for real. My grandma was one of those fans, and I may not have loved the show back then, but I really appreciate it now. The show was a lifeline for people who didn't trust the government, who thought we were being lied to en masse about everything, from chlorine in the water to chemtrails. Then I'd walk home through the woods in the dark, hoping that if I encountered anything, it would be the bear that lived in our backyard, and not a tractor beam of light from a flying saucer, slowly and methodically searching the forest for a young human to abduct and test. I always made it home, but sometimes I turned off the flashlight to make it harder for potential aliens to locate me, assuming they relied on my feeble light source. I would walk through the dark woods with the sounds of frogs, crickets, and owls around me. If the moon was out, I could see the path well enough. If I was lucky, I would have a dog with me. I'm not worried about alien abduction anymore. I live in a city, and there are more pressing earthly matters I'm concerned with. But when aliens or UFOs or flying saucers come up in conversation, I have a hard time writing off the true believers, the people who report sightings or abductions, the people who have a reason to believe, because I think they have a need to believe. I'm Liz MacArthur, and this is Beam Me Up. Chapter 2, The Voyager. This year I heard a story that brought me back to the summer of Freezer Freddy. It was the story of a friendly, down-to-earth guy who disappeared one stormy night. He left a note saying he was going on a journey through space. His name is Granger Taylor, and he was from Duncan, just north of Victoria, where I live now. Granger Taylor was an outgoing, friendly young man who had a brilliant mind for mechanics. He was also obsessed with UFOs. He built one in his yard in North Cowichan and would climb inside to spend hours reading about the potential for extraterrestrial life. In 1980, he left a note for his parents saying he was going on a 42-month journey with alien beings who had contacted him. He disappeared that night during a storm, leaving his parents distraught. Derek Zedenius covered the story for the Times Colonist newspaper when Taylor initially disappeared.
Hello.
Hi, is this Derek?
Oh, hi. Is this Elizabeth, eh?
Yeah, it is. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. So I have my recorder running, just so you know, as long as that's okay with you.
Yeah, you can do what you want.
Okay, great. So you were working at the Times Colonist at the time you wrote the story, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And you wrote the story a little bit after the fact. So can you tell me how you sort of became aware of it and why you decided to write that story?
Well, I mean, it was quite a bit after the fact because they'd waited like 51 months, I think, expecting Granger to return. So, like, he went missing in November 1980, and I got the story in 1985. And I can't recall how it came about, but the story came in, or I'd heard about it somehow, that there was this family who had... their son had gone off and on a UFO, and of course it's intriguing. You have to follow up on a case like that because there's so many unanswered parts to it, just what happened to him and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not too sure exactly how I got the story, but it was the kind of story that I love to investigate anyway.
Mm-hmm. So did you go up to Duncan and talk to his parents?
Oh, yeah. No. I spent a day or two in Duncan talking to the parents and to some people who knew Granger. I didn't have a whole lot of time to spend on it because there are a number of stories going on. But they certainly toured the little farm or the place where Granger lived and saw his room, and yeah, I can still remember that day very clearly. It was they had sort of preserved everything for him in anticipation that he'd be coming home, but of course the hopes were beginning to fade, you know, but they still had no satisfaction as to what exactly happened. And
I was reading, when I was sort of initially searching for information on Granger, I found a lot of articles about, about reported sightings on Vancouver Island, which I had never really heard of before, but there were like sort of a rash of them during that time.
Yeah, there were lots, and I think in that little story did we noted that there had been about 20 sightings of, but I never kept a record of the number, but there were a lot, yeah. And some of these were discounted, of course, but some of them were not explained. But
can you tell me what Granger's room looked like? Can you remember it?
Well, it was just a room in a fairly small... his primary interest, of course, was in science fiction and UFOs and things like that. And you know, today, if somebody came along, you might look at this person and say, perhaps he displayed some of the sort of the qualities or temperament characteristics of somebody with Asperger's, you know. And, you know, there have been a number of very famous people, scientists and so on, with similar kinds of characteristics. And it's very, very common for people with that syndrome to be tremendously interested in science fiction and maybe relive it, you know.
Did you see the flying saucer that he made in his yard? Was that still there?
Oh, yeah, of course it was still there. Still there, and even his sofa was in there, and you know that he. But this is like 4 years later, and kids have been playing in it, and it was in a bit of a state of disrepair. I don't think the parents really knew what to do. You know, they were just hoping that he would come back, and wanted everything to remain. But Granger himself, I think, had indicated that he would be just going on this trip and that he would be returning, but of course he never did. And I had left the newspaper a couple of years later. They discovered some wreckage on Mount Sicker, and they believed that that was Granger's truck, and possibly he had the belief that he might have committed suicide.
Yeah. So you mentioned the books that he was reading. Did you see like some of the books or titles when you were there?
Yeah, I did, and I have to, you know, they were really just on flying saucers, black holes, the secret forces of the pyramid, and flying saucers here and now, and from outer space, and oh, there's a whole box of them, you know, and those were. A sampling, and you know, clearly he was fascinated with that genre of literature. You know, he had tons of those books. You got to be careful. The internet's full of these strange stories, and you got to be careful that you about checking them out, because some of them are really wild, and you can't really rely totally on the information there. You know. Take it all with a little grain of salt.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about reporting on this story, or what you think about Granger Taylor?
Well, nothing. You know, I never met the man.
Yeah.
I never met him, that I was aware of, anyway. I wish you good luck in this.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great story.
Yeah, okay, bye-bye.
Take care, bye.
Speaking to people who knew Granger or who were alive at the time revealed a lot of mixed emotions. Family members warned me off. A woman who went to school with him said that they'd been paired together in class as dance partners because they were both social misfits in middle school. She said she had a speech impediment and was ostracized, and so she would pick him as a partner, and he was such a shy boy, he would always be grateful, and so they learned to dance together. She didn't want to take part in the documentary because those old wounds of being ostracized in school still run deep. I saw the property, though, where Granger Taylor lived. At the curve of a long road in North Cowichan, in the woods, is where the Taylor farm was. There's a grassy area where he had a cabin and all the cars he used to work on, cars and locomotives. And then there's an open space where he'd built the flying saucer. The flying saucer was sold years ago. Apparently, it appeared in the classified ads as a liveaboard flying saucer. His sister had lived in a cabin near him on the property. She was a character in her own right. She built herself a wrestling ring and then challenged a prominent wrestler at the time to a fight. I don't think it ever happened, though. She was also into guns, apparently, and old guns, like powder guns. And everyone at the school where she taught feared her.
Yeah,
Chapter 3, The Photographer. One of the first things that came up while I was reading about Granger was a book called In Advance of the Landing, Folk Concepts of Outer Space, written by Douglas Curran, a photographer who now lives in Victoria. The excerpt I stumbled across was the most tangible source I'd found up to that point. It was referenced in some of the more sensational material. In the 70s, Doug spent nearly 8 years driving around North America, documenting folk depictions of flying saucers with his camera.
I bought a used Renault 16, which is an ugly duckling little car. Most people would never even know today what it is. And I ripped out the rear seat, and I built a desk behind the driver's seat on one side, and the passenger seat folded down to make into a bed, and with the glove box open, I had room for my feet. And I made a set of screen windows for the back so I could sleep in there without the boogeyman reaching in and getting me at night. And I just started to drive, and I drove, and I drove. I put a CB radio in, so I'd get on. My handle was Flashbulb. And I would ask people, I'd say, hey, I'm looking for people's ideas of outer space. I'm looking for people who've built a rocket or a flying saucer in their backyard. And I'd go into newspaper offices. I'd go to radio stations. A lot of it I just drove. And it was happenstance. And it was something would come. I'd make a decision to turn some way. I'd take a left fork down an abandoned road out in the desert. And suddenly there's a man living out there in an old motorhome, and he's painting a picture of an encounter of a flying saucer with an airliner. Okay. That's really what it was. It was being out. I lived in my car, and I moved. I talked. I'd talk to anybody.
He was studying photojournalism at Ryerson at the time, and in his last year told the school he'd register and pay fees, but he'd be out on the road working on his project.
Ryerson. And I said, I'm not going to come back in September. I want to be enrolled, but I'm going to go on the road, and I'm going to look for folk concepts of outer space. And they said, okay. And that's what I did.
At Ryerson, Doug studied the work of other photographers, but found himself increasingly influenced by the way George Orwell viewed and talked about pop culture.
He really looks and sees the value. He sees the social and cultural aspirations that are manifested through popular culture. And I saw this stuff, and it started changing my focus on things. Of instead of looking at popular culture as low culture, I started to see it as a kind of drama. I saw it as aspirational. I saw it as holding the kind of keys for people's inner aspirations. So that came along at one point, and along with that, reading Carl Jung. And Jung talked about archetypes, and a tremendous piece that I found actually after I'd started the book, but Jung said all cultures create archetypes of deities, of supreme beings. And he said in a culture, a technological culture such as ours, it would be no surprise to find that we shape supreme deities in a technological fashion.
As Doug traveled around the country looking for flying saucers to photograph, he encountered many people with varied reasons for building the saucers. As time passed, the way in which the people building these constructions were received and thought about by their neighbors also changed.
What I found, a number of people, for instance, a man, John Shepherd, who lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, when I first met him, he was viewed as this wacko, this eccentric wacko living in a house. What John did actually is he converted his grandmother's house into a UFO detection station. Hmm. And he was a completely self-taught electronics engineer. And he went in and he bought scrap and he bought surplus things and he created a massive pulsing generator that generated high voltage frequency signals that would crackle and zoop and whoop as it generated all these Gaussian electrode currents across itself. And he believed that he would communicate with aliens. And of course, when I first met him, which would have been about 1980 or 81, he was viewed as this wacko. But when I went back in like 5-6 years later, what was interesting was the way that the public perception in the town had changed, and he became an object of pride within the town and acceptance. So this talked about a whole societal change, a change in the idea of aliens contacting and being in communication with Earthlings. Then I'd say that in the later years, post-90, the phenomena changed again. And as our society became paranoid, you started seeing the reports. The aliens were no longer quite so benign. They were now doing biopsies and sampling humans and impregnating them and holding them captive on spaceships and inserting tracking things or metal beads and things up their nasal cavities. But this kind of aspect of surveillance and a kind of malevolence crept into it, which for me, I just start reading it in terms of our changes of our society.
One of the stops Doug made on his journey was in Duncan, where he visited the Taylor's home shortly after Granger went missing.
And when I came over, someone mentioned something about, they didn't know many details, but this guy who had disappeared. And so I took myself from Shawnigan up to Duncan and went to the local newspaper and went through their archives, talked to a reporter, and worked my way over to the home of Granger Taylor's parents. So this was probably about 18 months after he had disappeared. And they were heartbroken. It was sad. There was an elderly couple who obviously cared and loved their son a great deal. And he disappeared one night in a violent windstorm after telling them that he was going away on a 42-month trip in a flying saucer and disappeared. And they kept his bedroom, everything untouched, all of his tools, everything was left at that point waiting for him. I went back in 86 or 87, and they still had everything there untouched. I was able to talk to one close friend of his and, you know, people nearby at the cafe where he used to go. And again, he was seen as this eccentric kind of genius. You know, if you go online, you can read now, you know, pretty easily about him. At that point, it was more difficult. Again, this is pre-internet. Now everyone just borrows from everyone else in, you know, unascribed sources, as it were. But at that point, nobody knew where he was, what had happened. And, you know, things like, you know, the machines he'd worked in, you know, his bulldozer and the locomotive that he'd hauled out of the wood and rehabilitated and, you know, at this point is now part of the BC Lumber and Mining Museum. So, you know, again, a place like Duncan, you know, where you've got a lot of sort of can-do, practical people. And even there, he stood out as being exceptional. He only had a grade 8 education. And he was this big, friendly guy, you know, 240 pounds, kind of like a big kid, friendly and welcoming to everyone. And so, you know, he wasn't a hermit. And he was, I think, 28. And so, again, here's an odd story. Why? What? How did the belief get so entrenched that it filled his world? It completed his world for him. You know, he wasn't a He wasn't a manic depressive. He wasn't a violent person. He wasn't somebody who